Welcome to the Emotionally Intelligent Recruiter, presented by me, Caroline Stokes. As a recruiter, you're here because you want to fast-track your emotional intelligence curve so you can manage data, enhance candidate experience and selection, plus improve your company's employer brand and for you to become even more successful. At theeirecruiter.com, you can download 70 tips from best-selling leadership authors, entrepreneurs, artificial intelligence explorers, emotional intelligence experts, leaders in recruitment, and more to get a little bit of extra help on this EI journey. Dr. Marshall Goldsmith is the best-selling author of Triggers, and What Got You Here Won't Get You There. Marshall is a number one business coach, has been awarded as one of the top 50 thinkers, and is a world-renowned business education leader and coach for CEOs and leaders who want to perform better. During this episode, he openly shares his learnings, perspectives, and teaches us all how to move forward. I hope this episode is as much a treat for you as it was for me. Marshall, it is such a pleasure to have you on the podcast.
Oh, thank you so much for inviting me.
I have so many questions for the audience. You're going to have a lot of new people on listening in that have a recruitment background or maybe haven't even heard of you before. And then there's going to be the people that are like me, know you from reading your books many years ago, following your videos, knowing about you on Inc., etc., and you know, really understanding a lot about what you've done and what you've brought. So I'm hoping that this podcast will cover both audiences very much for human capital developers. But I want to kick off with a question, which is, how did you get into doing what you're doing now?
Well, you know, many years ago, I met a very famous person named Dr. Paul Hersey. He was kind enough to let me follow him around to try to learn to do what he did. And then I was a professor, and one day he became double booked. And he said, "Can you do what I do?" I said, "I don't know." He said, "I need help. Can you do this?" I said, "I don't know." He said, "I'll pay you $1,000 for one day." I was making $15,000 for 1 year. I said, "I'll try." Now, that was 40 years ago, and I was 28 years old. That was an incredible amount of money for a kid 40 years ago. I said, "I'll give it a shot." I did a program for the Metropolitan Life Insurance Company. They were incredibly angry when I showed up because I wasn't him. But I got ranked first place of all the speakers, and they were happy. So he called me back. He said, "Look, they were angry at first, but then they were happy. They want you to do it again. Can you do it again?" I said, "Sign me up." And that's how I got into executive education, just purely by a lot of life is good luck, you know, having a good mentor, teacher. So he was a good teacher, and I was very lucky.
Amazing. Amazing. So it's 40 years ago. Absolutely. So you were a pioneer of the coaching environment back then. So, and the coaching industry
there
has
wasn't
changed.
There wasn't anything called coaching back then.
What was it called then?
I don't know. I mean, I'm a pioneer in something called 360 degree feedback.
Mm.
So I did feedback, and I got into coaching kind of the same way. The CEO said, "I have this kid working for us. He's young, smart, dedicated, hardworking, driven to achieve, stubborn, know-it-all jerk." He said, "It'd be worth a fortune to me if I could turn this kid around." So having done this before, I said, "Well, I like fortunes. Maybe I could help." He said, "I doubt it." That's when I came up with an idea. I said, "I'll work with him for a year. If he gets better, pay me. If he doesn't get better, it's all free." CEO said, "Sold." That's how I got into coaching. And all my coaching, I only get paid for results.
Very nice. Very nice. So in terms of, I mean, you've obviously got a great model there. It works very well for you. There's a lot of coaches out there that would say, "Oh my gosh, I wouldn't be able to work on that kind of basis because, you know, well, of whatever reason." But if I can just ask you about your evolution, and you obviously were very, very confident. You've been in that kind of, in that 360 feedback and then obviously coaching environment for the past 40 years. So you've got more confidence in that particular area than anyone else probably, other than some of the other leaders in the industry. But can I ask you a question, which is, you must have had some really tough times. It's tough learning times where, because you're a pioneer, you're having to work out how to help people evolve. Can you describe some of the hardest times where you had to learn and adapt and evolve?
Well, on American Airlines alone, I have over 11 million frequent flyer miles.
Wow.
So, you know, I mean, that's one level that sounds kind of funny. Ha, ha, ha. Here's 11 million frequent flyer miles. That's a lot of miles. That's a lot of nights spent on airplanes and traveling and, you know, And, you know, I've got 36 books done, 36 books. That's a lot of books. So I had these three young guys come to my house. They were average age about 32, and they're getting their PhDs. And this one guy says, well, we're going to do what you do when we get out of school. So I said, what's that mean? He said, well, we want to coach CEOs. And I'm sitting there listening to this guy. I'm thinking, you know, what are you smoking? You know, I have, you know, I've been doing this for 40 years. I have 11 million frequent flyer miles, and I've done 36 books, and you haven't, right? So you're going to be me when you graduate? Well, maybe not. You know, there's this thing about paying dues. And you kind of, you know, you can look at it the other end and say, well, gee, that's nice. But, you know, you sort of have to pay dues. And a lot of the dues, there's no short-term gratification for it. There's nobody patting you on the head. And especially things like writing books and articles and all that. There's nobody telling you that you're wonderful. Just hard work. And you have to just do it day after day after day after day after day.
A lot like going to the gym, where you, the only way that you're going to see results is if you do it day after day after day.
It's exactly like going to the gym. And it's, you know, like Arnold Schwarzenegger said, nobody got muscles by watching me lift weights. Well, you know, you got to lift it. You got to lift the weights.
Indeed. So I hear from what you're saying is that it's about stamina and about resilience. So, for example, when things just aren't going your way and you've written your 5,000th article and nobody's patting you on the back apart from maybe some groupies like me saying, oh, Marshall, you have just changed my life with that statement there. You just have to keep going.
Got to keep going. And the hard part is not when you're at my level of life. The hard part is when you're not. Mm-hmm. Because then, I mean, now there are a lot of people pat me on the back. I mean, I probably, you know, get patted on the back constantly. Well, it's a lot easier now. But the hard thing is when you're young and getting started and there's no one patting you on the back.
I think that's a really interesting point, because in today's society, we are expecting quite quick rewards, and you don't get that reward loop so quickly without putting the hard work in and paying your dues, as you mentioned earlier. So what would you say to somebody who is just wanting to adapt their career to take on a coaching qualification or whatever it is? What could you say to inspire them to go, you know what, this is something I need to do. This is a way of life versus an instant win.
I would say it would depend on their age and, you know, depend on their age and what type of coach they wanted to be. But if the person were young, when I say young, I'd say probably 20s or maybe even early 20s, I would definitely say I would get a PhD if you're young. If you're above 30, I probably wouldn't, just because it's just such a grind today. If you're above 30, I probably wouldn't say get a PhD. If you're under 30, I would, just because I think, you know, you're not going to do that much coaching at a young age anyway. It's something you have the rest of your life. So if you're young, I think it's a great idea. If you're older, I would not recommend it at all. And then also it depends, do you work in a company now? If you work in a company, what I'd say is, I often think it's good for people who work in a corporation that want to go into an independent type of life to get what I call a bridge relationship, where you still can work with that corporation as a consultant. And you've got a couple, 3 years there to sort of build up your business and your life. The one thing I find in my field is, especially the coaching field, many people are really good coaches. They're just terrible business people. And, you know, the average income for someone called a coach for coaching is abysmal, at $35,000 a year or some terrible number, right? Bag boys make more. And they're good coaches sometimes, but they're not good business people. And the one thing I try to encourage people who want to go into the field of coaching is not only do you need to understand the professional elements of coaching, you need to understand the business elements of coaching. Because, you know, if you want to be a great coach, well, you need to think about it, not just am I a good coach professionally, but do I have a good business sense as well? Mm. And many coaches really are really good coaches professionally, but have very poor business sense.
I hear what you're saying, and I think, and I hear you from that. I've experienced it as well with other coaches that they're missing that particular aspect. They're missing that business acumen, and I'm almost thinking, wow, this might be a gap in the market for a company out there to train individual coaches on how to be a better to develop that business acumen, a bit like going to business school, but for coaches who are obviously a little bit more mature.
Yeah, and it's very interesting because many coaches have what I call the ridiculous idea of my good work should speak for itself.
Mm-hmm.
And then they think that is basically a sign of humility, but it's actually a sign of arrogance. What they're really saying is, I'm so competent that my good work will speak for itself, and I don't have to do marketing, I don't have to do sales, I'm above all of that because I'm so good. Well, you know, no, you're not. That's ridiculous. If that were true, no company would have a marketing function. You know, you just build a good product and it sells itself. Well, that's not the way the world works.
Quite right, quite right. So through all of this, I mean, again, you're the gold standard model of a coach that has done extremely well over 40 years through hard grind, through innovating the industry and really demonstrating on so many different counts just that hard graft really does pay off. Have you ever felt satisfied?
I felt very satisfied. Mm-hmm. See, I'm a Buddhist. My basic philosophy is be happy now. I'm very much not into guilt. I'm not into misery. And I'm incredibly good at forgiving myself for my previous sins.
I love that. Okay, so that's good.
So, and I think, whatever sins I have, real or imagined, committed in the past, guess what? I'm not going to fix them anyway. Why carry that crap around? Yeah, I'm not into guilt and shame and, you know, all that stuff.
Good. Yes. And it's a way of life, isn't it? Enables you to move forward. Otherwise, you're just holding yourself back.
Yeah. And also you feel bad.
Yeah.
For
absolutely.
What? The world doesn't Indeed. Become a better place because you feel bad.
So wise. Okay, so I want to talk to you about what you think the future of the coaching industry is in the world of AI, in the world of machine learning. And, you know, you can now download apps that will enable you to help coach you through life. There's something that Kim Scott has created from her book, which is called... Goodness gracious me, what is it called? I don't know if you know her. She's from formerly from Google and Apple, and she's created a great book. And her app is about being able to catch what you're doing with regards to feedback in the moment. And there's a lot of movement in this particular space. So I'm kind of wondering, how do you think AI, the new technology revolution, will enhance the coach's job today?
I'm very positive about it. I mean, I think anything you can do to build in follow-up is good. And historically, there's been very little follow-up in any field, medicine, coaching, anything. And so anything you can do to build in reinforcement, follow-up is a good thing. So, I think I wrote in an article years ago called something said, is this a nightmare or a dream come true? And the answer is it's to me, both a nightmare and a dream come true. 20 years ago, I unfortunately made a prediction that turned out to be accurate. I said within 20 or 30 years, they're going to have something called instant download TV quality audiovisual transmission over something like the internet. And when that happens, media addiction will far surpass drug addiction and alcohol addiction combined as a social problem. We're already there. Media addiction in our society is a disaster. The average kid that's flunking out of school spends 55 hours a week on non-academic media. 55 hours a week. It's a disease. Well, you know, in my new book I'm writing, it's called Leading Your Own Life. It says, you know, don't live Kim Kardashian's life or don't live vicariously. If you want to have a great life, live your own life. Don't get lost in other people's lives. So can media be a blessing? I think it can be a total blessing in terms of, you know, providing ongoing reinforcement, ideas, access to the global mind, so many positives. So I'm always working on developing new stuff myself. I mean, I make videos every week. On LinkedIn, I have videos every week. So I'm a great believer. I have 915,000 followers. Mm-hmm. So I'm a great believer in social media. I'm a great believer in can keep coming up with new ideas, new ways to develop computer apps. I think it's all very positive. I think there's also a dark side, which is, you know, if you're not careful, you become addicted to this short-term stimulation without a lot of meaning.
Mm. Yep, I hear you. Have you, this is a curveball question, do you have Google Home or anything like that in your house?
Not so much.
No,
again, you have to realize I travel all the time.
Yes, of course.
So, you know, the question is, my house is, for me, kind of a puzzling question since I live in four different places, number one. And then number two, I travel all the time. So where is my, quote, house? That would be a kind of a puzzling question.
Yeah. So the reason why I ask is that one thing I heard recently is that there's this new technology, and it escapes me who created it, but it's happening and it's in the background, which is that there's technology that's going to be able to identify how, when somebody is talking, the technology is going to be able to identify what mood they're in. Based, and I'm just connecting the dots. And okay, so what mood are they in based on who they're about to meet? And could there be that kind of coaching feedback right then through the power of, you know, AI, machine learning, etc., that will enable to go, okay, yes, I'm in the moment. And I'm curious about what you might think about that particular scenario in the future.
Oh, look, I basically love it. And anything that helps is good. Mm-hmm. And I think it can help. I mean, the point is, the hard part is winnowing out what is really helpful from what's just a game or an amusement or nonsense, which is not so easy.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm a great believer in the use of new technology in the future. And, you know, I think stuff like that can be great. Let's say it learns that I'm in a bad mood and I'm going to meet someone. They'll say, look, be careful, you're in a bad mood. You may want to change the way you're thinking and feeling right now. You're probably going to have a dysfunctional interaction. That could be great.
Absolutely. Absolutely. No, that's good. That's good.
Yeah. Okay. Now I'm going to teach you something. Are you ready for some free coaching for you?
Oh, I'd love it.
Okay. Breathe. I just said something you agreed with. And you know what, what was the first word out of your mouth out of I spoke? Do you remember what the word was?
Oh, I don't, but please tell me.
It was no. You said no, that's good.
Oh, that's so crazy. Thank you.
Now, you see, if it's so good, why did you say no?
You're right. And I've seen you do
something.
That with somebody else. That's wonderful. Thank you.
It's fun to watch me do it with them.
So much fun, because you don't realize that you do it. And it's like, why did I do it? Why did I say that?
Let me explain why. You're a very bright person, and this is a smart person disease. It's very hard for a smart person to hear someone tell us something we already know without us pointing out we already know it.
Uh-huh.
Know that's good means no, Marshall. Of course, I already knew that and agree with you.
Oh, I feel so foolish now. Thank you.
This is what I do for a living.
I love it. Thank you.
This is so hard. We don't even hear ourselves say these words, and we do it over and over again.
Mm-hmm. So right.
Yeah, I don't. Did you see that videotape of me where the guy tries to interview me and he keeps saying no and but over and over again?
I did see that. I did, and I just loved that because he was constantly tripping himself up, and I could understand from his perspective he was probably bubbling with anticipation, and he just kept falling into that trap. So yeah, it was
over
very
and
interesting.
Over
and over, yeah. and you were just in peals of laughter. It was very funny.
Okay, back to work.
So thank you for that. So what do you think it takes? Based on what we were just saying about AI technology being able to catch you in the moment and being able to help you, sometime in the future, that's bound to happen. The next question is, you wrote a book called Triggers. And that's very, in my mind, that's very similar. But for people that haven't read Triggers, or I know that people were reading it over Christmas as well, and I've been advising people to read it for a very long time. How would you describe Triggers, your book that I read a few years ago?
Well, as we journey through life, why don't we become the people that we want to become? See, I think the real challenge we have in life is not understanding who we want to become. It's becoming who we want to become. Most of us know who we want to become. We all want to be these nice people who are in perfect physical condition and are great friends and family members and yada, yada, yada. We all have this dream of this person. As we journey through life, why don't we become these people? Well, if you look at it, employee engagement is an all-time low. Depression is at an all-time high. Why don't we become these people that we dream of becoming? Well, as we journey through life, we're constantly bombarded by triggers. Now, what's a trigger? A trigger is any stimulus that might impact our behavior. Could be a sight, a sound, a word, a URL. Any stimulus that impacts our behavior is a trigger. In some cases, these triggers push us toward becoming the person that we want to become. In most cases, quite the opposite is true. They push us away from becoming the person that we want to become. And in the new world, we're constantly bombarded with stimulus. For example, you want to go online to look something up. It's going to take 5 minutes, you think. You go to Google, 5 minutes. Mm-hmm. 3 hours later, you're still online. You have no idea why you went online in the first place. And you say, where did I do with the last 3 hours? Well, what happened is triggers. The internet is just geared. There are people, by the way, being paid billions and billions of dollars collectively with one mission in life, to make you addicted to some site, to some pornography, to some entertainment, to some story, to something. And so what happens is, as you go online, this stuff is very obviously enticing. And you think, oh, that looks interesting, click. Oh, that looks interesting, click. That looks interesting, click. And the next thing you know, you're gone. You're gone. You forgot why you went online in the first place. So there are different schools of thought about life. One school of thought is the world controls me. This is B.F. Skinner, Harvard psychologist, behavioral theory. Basically, we're like a stimulus response machine being controlled by the world. The other school of thought is that I control the world. This is like the book, The Secret, and the motivational speech. You know, you can do it. If you dream it, it'll happen, etc. Well, the problem with the I control the world school is they have all these stories about, you know, Michael Jordan was a basketball player and they told him he couldn't make it and he got cut from the team, but now he's a star. So therefore, you know, if you do this, you can be like Michael Jordan. Wrong, wrong, wrong. You're not Michael Jordan. You're not going to be Michael Jordan. The odds on you being Michael Jordan are a chance of a snowball's chance in hell. You're not LeBron James. You're not Oprah. You're not one of these movie stars. And it did happen to them, but that doesn't mean it's going to happen to you. This is called a survivor bias. Jimmy had cancer. He wished it went away, and it did. Therefore, if you wish away, you wish your cancer go away, it will. No, wrong. There's no research to prove this. It's all nonsense. Well, what happens is, so people tend to believe either, A, I'm a victim controlled by the environment, or B, I'm like a little god who controls the environment. So the idea of triggers is we control it, and simultaneously it controls us. And the whole idea of the book is just shift the equation a little bit. So more and more of your life, you are controlling it as opposed to it is controlling you. You're never going to get so you have total control over the environment. If you did, you know, nobody would die. On the other hand, the idea is you at least expand your level of control. So more and more you're living your own life as opposed to being controlled by this external life. And in my new book, I talk about things like Facebook, which is a disaster. I mean, you know, there've been a lot of, even Mark Zuckerberg talks about this. The more people spend time on Facebook, the more depressed they are for two reasons. One, you see this sanitized, glorified view of who people are. They don't show you the ugly pictures. You only see the pretty pictures, right? And now all of a sudden you start feeling bad. You think, my kids aren't that nice and pretty, and I'm not that pretty. And gee, these people have such a great life. I wish I were them. Well, the reality is it's not them. It's some sanitized, fictionalized view of who people are. And it's depressing because you think I'm not them. And then on the other hand, it's depressing because you feel like a phony. You think, well, that show I'm putting on Facebook, that's not really me. That's this fake me. And I feel a need to pretend to be pretty and pretend to be on top of everything so I can make this show to my friends. So in my new book, I talk a lot about this, that really be careful. You don't spend your life trying to gain approval from people who could care less.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Very interesting. So tell me more about your new book. When is it coming out?
Oh, it won't be out. That book won't be out until 2019. My next book is coming out in April. It's called How Women, it's a book for women called How Women Rise with Sally Helgeson.
Nice.
She's the lead author. Oh, I'm very excited about it. It'll be out in April, How Women Rise, R-I-S-E. And it talks about some unique challenges of women in terms of all the stuff that I teach. And a guy named Mike Dulworth, he sent Sally and I an email. I'm going to see Sally today. He sent us an email. An email said, crazy idea on the tagline. He said, your book, What Got You Here, Won't Get You There, is a really good book, but it's largely written about men's problems. Why don't you write one of those just for women? Because they have some unique issues. So he sent it to Sally and I. I said to Sally, you know, hey, you're an expert on women's topics, not me. If you want to do it, I'm happy to do it. What do you think? She said, let's do it. So we did it. I thought we'd maybe get a $40,000 advance. We got a $400,000 advance.
Nice.
And the publisher, oh, it's really nice. Publishers are very much behind it. And
excellent.
She's a great author. She's a great author. She's a great writer, too. She can write far better than I can. And so she's a great writer. So I'm very positive about the book. That'll be out in April.
I can't wait. That's absolutely wonderful. And it's so appropriate
right
now.
One of the punchlines. The average woman is seen as a better leader than the average man. The average woman has one issue to deal with much more than the average man. The desire to be the perfect everything to everyone. Women are statistically much harder on themselves than men. So the one coaching I have for women more than men is don't be too hard on yourself. You can't be that perfect everything to everyone. You know, don't be too hard on yourself.
Agreed. But then you have to go back to triggers, which is why are they being hard on themselves? What triggers do they have in their mind? And sometimes unpacking that is hugely important so that they can unpack it, they can identify it, and then they're able to process it in the moment so they're able to move past that. And that takes a little bit of time. It can take anywhere from 1 minute, a bit like when you said to me, Caroline, you just said no. And right now I am consciously ensuring that I do not say no at the beginning of a sentence again. Or it can be something where you're actually working on it consciously for a week or weeks or months or maybe even years.
Right. So in the book, we talk about why these things tend to happen and some strategies. So I feel very good about the book.
It's perfectly timed. That's all I have to say. With everything that is happening in the world right now, and it's perfectly timed, and I'm very excited to know that this is coming out. And I think it will be a very powerful book. Clearly, the book publisher could sense that as well. So congratulations to everybody.
Oh, thank you. Thank you.
Very good. So I want to go on to a bit more about what got you here won't get you there. And I like the way you just talked about the fact that when you wrote that book, it was mostly with a male lens, which I completely understand why that was the case. But I actually read it with a human lens, so I don't really put genders aside. And that's fine. But I want to ask you, in terms of the process that I often speak to people about, whether it's recruiters or leaders, when coaching them, and especially when people have just moved into their new job, what got you at that particular point won't actually get you through the next 3 months so you can make that impact, or won't get you through whatever learning you need to be able to learn so you can move forward. So what elements do you believe are still valid from that book and hopefully the new book?
I think most of it applies for everybody.
Mm-hmm.
And the overall theme applies to everyone. I mean, basically, I just met yesterday with the new CEO of a company called Novartis, a brilliant young guy. He's 41 years old, already the CEO of one of the 50 biggest companies in the world. And you know, just a great guy. And we talked about this and, you know, a brilliant guy who's used to going to school and taking classes and making A's. He went to Harvard Medical School. So I'm a friend of his mentor, Dr. Jim Kim, who's president of the World Bank. He went to Harvard Medical School. He's a brilliant guy, you know. And he's used to proving his right and being impressive and all that, which is great when you're a student, but it's not great when you're a CEO. So big transition is learning the higher up you go, the less you want to make it about you and the more you make it about everyone around you. It's not about you proving how smart you are and gaining approval and being right. And it's really about letting go. One of my good coaching clients said, for the great individual achiever, it's all about me. For the great leader, it's all about them. Well, it's hard to make this transition from being a great individual achiever, which is all about you and proving you're smart and right and special, to realizing I'm a leader here. I mean, I get to win all the arguments anyway. It's not about me. It's about them. I need to make them smart and right and special. And I don't need to prove anything. It's a big, easy, by the way, theoretically, this is quite easy to understand. Practically, it's hard to do. I mean, if you read the book, What Got You Here, Won't Get You There, you read funny story after funny story after funny story. It's very tempting. It's tempting to read the book and think, well, these people are idiots. The average person in that book has an IQ of 150 and they're CEOs of multi-billion-dollar companies. They're not idiots. They'll tell you, though, this stuff is hard to do. It's very deeply ingrained in us.
It is, and I agree. And I've got a statement every now and again which helps me get through the day sometimes, which is, it's okay, we're all idiots. It's all right.
Yeah.
Well, we are human.
What I learned in my coaching is my biggest challenge as a coach is called customer selection. You know, if I pick the right customers, my coaching process always works. And I pick the wrong customers, it never works. And, you know, the client I spent the least amount of time with improved the most. The client I spent the most amount of time with didn't improve at all, and they didn't get paid. That's humbling. So I did a little chart. On one dimension, it was called time spent with Marshall Goldsmith. The other dimension was called improvement. There's a clear negative correlation between spending time with me and getting better. I thought, well, that's troubling. So I go talk to my client to improve the most I spent the least amount of time with. Now, his name is Alan Mulally. Alan was the CEO of Ford, CEO of the year in the United States, ranked number 3 great leader in the world. The stock goes from $1 to $18, and just a wonderful human being, just a nice man. So I talked to Alan. I said, Alan, of all the people I've coached, you improve the most. I spent the least amount of time with you. So I showed him my little chart. I said, Alan, the way this troubling chart looks, had you never met me, you would have really been good. Now, what should I learn about coaching from you? He said, your biggest challenge as a coach is called customer selection. Never make the coaching process about your own ego. How smart do you think you are? Make it about the great people you work with, how hard they work, and how proud you are of them. Then he said, as a CEO for Ford, my job wasn't that different. He said, I don't design the cars. I don't build the cars. I don't sell the cars. I have to have great people. And every day I told myself, leadership's not about me. It's about them. Well, that's why the guy's a great leader. What is the biggest problem of all the coaches I've trained? I've trained thousands of people to be coaches. What is the biggest problem of every coach I've trained, including, by the way, myself? What is our biggest problem? The ego of the coach. We want people to get better so we can look in that mirror and feel good about who? Feel good about ourselves. We want them to get better so we can look in the mirror and say, look at that person got so much better because of me. See, it's really all about me, and aren't I wonderful. It's hard not to do that.
It is. Humans have egos. It's whether or not you're a coach or anybody else. So I'm really curious, because you're a Buddhist, is that something that you have to tackle all the time?
Fall into this trap on a daily basis.
And it's awareness of that trap.
Right. And, you know, I sometimes get better and sometimes not. Now, one thing I teach people is something called the daily question process. Daily question process, you get out an Excel spreadsheet. By the way, the daily question process takes 3 minutes a day, costs nothing, will help people get better at almost anything. Now, some of your listeners might be skeptical. 3 minutes a day, costs nothing, help me get better at almost anything? Sounds too good to be true. Half the people that start doing this quit within 2 weeks. And they don't quit because it doesn't work. They quit because it does work. It's incredibly easy to understand. It's just incredibly difficult to do. Now, I have a woman, I don't pay her, we're peer coaches, Jasmine. Jasmine calls me up on the phone every day. She called me right before I called you. And every day, Jasmine listens to me read questions I wrote and provide answers I wrote every day. Somebody said, well, why do you have this woman call you up every day? Don't you know the theory about how to change behavior? I wrote the theory about how to change behavior. Yeah, I know the theory. I wrote the theory. That's why I pay the woman to call me every day. Why? I know how hard it is. My name is Marshall Goldsmith. I got ranked number one executive coach in the world and number one leadership thinker. And my book was the number one bestseller. I pay a woman to call me up on the phone every day just to listen to me read questions I wrote, provide answers I wrote every day. Why do I do this? My name is Marshall Goldsmith. I'm too cowardly to do this by myself. I'm too undisciplined to do this by myself. I need help. And it's okay. It's okay. Once we admit it's okay to need help, you get over this ridiculous macho, I can do it all on my own crap, life is so much better.
Thank you. I love that story, because I know you wrote about this a long, long time ago, and I wrote about it as well. And I wanted to ask you, do you still have that person, and now I know her name, Jasmine, calling you every day? And you clearly do. And it sounds
this
like...
Good morning.
That's wonderful. That's wonderful.
45 minutes ago.
And what I like about what you're saying here is that you're not, because I was going to ask you, you know, have you transitioned to using something like a Way of Life app instead? And I think what I like is that there is such discipline in if Jasmine is calling you on the dot at 7 o'clock every single morning, asking you those questions, and for you to actually take that brain time to verbalize it, and then to identify where the gap is in what you should have done or could have done, and so you can actually rectify it for this day. That's huge. Whereas an app, it's very easy to not respond to it for a few days and give yourself excuses and find ways not to actually respond to it and say, oh, yeah, I'm still doing okay.
yeah, sure. It's easier. And by the way, it's not so humiliating with an app to point out what you did wrong.
Yeah. So does Jasmine laugh with you, or is she a situation? Is she in the situation where she has to be very, very strict with you?
No, it's not about coaching. This mm-hmm. is just about, you know,
listening.
Look, I know what I did wrong. You know, every day I screw up something. We pretty much all do. At least I do every day. And the hard thing is every day having to look at it. For example, one of my daily questions, if anybody would like all of my questions, send me an email, marshall@marshallgoldsmith.com. I'll send them all my questions so that we need to write them down. And by the way, the idea is you write your own questions. Mine are just by way of example. One of my questions every day is, how many times yesterday did you try to prove you were right when it wasn't worth it? I'm almost never got a zero my whole life. Kind of hard for that old professor not to be right all the time.
You know,
how many angry or destructive comments did you make about people yesterday? Well, you know, if we want to treat people with respect, why are we stabbing them in the back? You know, how many minutes did you walk? How many push-ups? How many sit-ups? Just all kinds of questions about life. How many minutes did you write? So this is a great discipline. It's incredibly difficult to do. As I say, most people can't do it over 2 weeks.
So we may need Jasmine's number as well, so we can all ask her to call us as well. All right. So you also have a program called 100 Coaches. How did this start?
Well, it's very interesting. I went to a program taught by my good friend Aisha Bursell. She's one of the world's great designers. And in this program, one of the exercises you do is you write down, who are your heroes? So my heroes are all these really nice, generous people. People like Frances Hesselbein and Alan Mulally and Jim Kim and Peter Drucker and Warren Bennis, and just really nice people who are great teachers. Some of these people, I was supposed to be their coach, which is kind of a joke because I learned about 10 times from them what they learned from me. So anyway, they're very generous, kind people, and they never charged me any money. So she said, well, okay, why don't you be like them? So I said, well, that's a great idea. So I'm going to second what I do. I'm going to adopt 15 people, teach them everything I know for free. And the only price is when they get old, they have to do the same thing. So I make a selfie video and put it on LinkedIn. Selfie video, you know, my name is Marshall Goldsmith. Who's who I am. I'm going to adopt these 15 people, teach them everything I know for free. And the only price is when you get old, you have to do the same thing. If you're interested, let me know. It turned out the most widely viewed video in the history of LinkedIn. I have 16,000 applicants for this position. I know, for 15 slots, I had 16,000 applicants. I mean, to put it in perspective, Harvard Business School has 9,700 applicants for 900 positions. I had 16,000 applicants for 15 positions. So then I decided to expand it from 15 to 100. So now I've adopted 100 people. And I don't know if you've seen the list of who the people are.
I have been following.
It's pretty amazing. I mean, you know, these are like, oh yeah, I mean, it's like the head of the Mayo Clinic and the dean of Harvard Medical School and the head of St. Jude's Children's Hospital and the woman's in charge of Sesame Street, the mission control director of NASA, and, you know, 12 of the top 100 business thinkers. So it's an amazing list of people. And so I'm trying to teach them everything I know for free. And the only price is when they get old, they do the same thing. So it's been a fun project, a very, very nice project, a very positive, upbeat kind of thing to do. And it's a nice kind of legacy thing. You know, you get old, you figure, what the heck, I'm going to die anyway. Might as well do a little good here.
Admirable. Thank you. Next question for you is, do you predict any new organizational challenges for organizations in the future? Or is it the same?
Well, I think, you know, I'm really more of an expert on the leader of the future than the organization of the future. But, mm-hmm. you know, five qualities. One is global thinking. More and more, we're entering into the world where, you know, you're dealing with people globally. I just was in Russia and I gave a talk and there were 17,000 people in the audience in Moscow. I mean, I've been to exactly 100 different countries and, you know, I travel all around the world. So globalization is coming. And, you know, we need to think globally, not locally. Second thing is appreciation of diversity. But diversity is not just, you know, women or minorities in America. Diversity means global diversity. And looking at diversity from different countries, backgrounds, religions, and all around the world. Then the third element would be technological savvy. The leader of the future doesn't have to be a technologist. But the leader of the future also has to understand how technologies can impact in the world, and that's just part of life. Then the next variable is building alliances and partnerships. More and more leadership is about building relationships across, not just up and down, and really being a partnership builder and alliance builder. And then finally, it's something called shared leadership. Peter Drucker said the leader of the past knew how to tell, the leader of the future will know how to ask. More and more leaders will manage people called knowledge workers, which means they know more about what they're doing than you do. And if you manage someone who knows more than you, you have to ask and listen and learn. You're more of a facilitator than you are a boss. And so the leader of the future is going to be more of a person who facilitates learning, not the omnipotent source of the learning. Mm-hmm. So those are five changes.
Thank you. And in terms of those five changes, it's wonderful that we have this podcast recording for this, because it enables people to think differently about how people need to adjust and with regards to their thinking, and so they're able to keep up. And then we are able to then go back to what got you here won't get you there. So what do you see being the biggest stumbling block for leaders to get to that point where they're able to focus on making the necessary mindset changes for those five areas?
Ego. Because I'll give you a great positive case study is my friend Alan. Alan goes to Ford. The stock is at $1. He leaves, it's $18. When the stock is $1, the company is losing $17 billion with the B dollars in 1 year. $17 billion they're losing in 1 year. So Alan has the top 16 leaders. He said, give me your top five priorities, red, yellow, green. Green is we're on plan. Yellow is I'm not on plan, have a strategy to get there. And red is I'm not on plan, I have no strategy. The first meeting, red, yellow, green. 16 times 5, 80 priorities. First meeting, 80 green. Everyone says we're on plan. Now they're losing $17 billion and everyone says they're on plan. So on every project, by the way. Not only every project on plan. So Alan says, well, we're on plan for everything and we're losing $17 billion. I guess our plan must be to lose at least $17 billion because that's where we are. Go do it again. Finally, Mark Fields says red, and he stands up and applauds and says, thank you for saying red. Thank you for saying red. He said, you're not on plan. You don't know how to get there. You're lost and confused. He said, it's okay. Then he said something I've never heard a CEO say. Brilliant. My name is Alan Mulally. I'm the CEO of the Ford Motor Company. I want to assure you of one thing. I know less than you. I know less than you. Well, how many CEOs you hear over here say that?
I don't think I have.
He's not so many. Now he says, you don't know the answer. And he says, I don't either. Why don't we work together and find someone who knows the answer? I mean, that sounds childishly obvious. How many CEOs do it? None. About 98% of CEOs would say, well, my good friend J.P. Garnier was CEO of GlaxoSmithKline. He retired. I said, what'd you learn about leadership as a CEO? I said, one thing. See, my suggestions become orders. Now, I said, if they're smart, they're orders. And if they're stupid, they're orders. If I want them to be orders, they are. And if they don't, they're orders anyway. My suggestions are orders. I said, what'd you learn from me when I was your coach? He said, one thing, before I speak, breathe. And ask myself, is it worth it before I talk? I said, half the time, what did I conclude? Am I right? Maybe. Is it worth it? No. Well, back to my friend Alan. If this guy says red, and Alan says, have you thought of, you know what he would have done? Sir, yes, sir. He would salute the flag and go do the idiot thing that Alan suggested, even though Alan knows nothing about the topic. Mm-hmm. Why, he's the CEO. His suggestions are orders. Alan has enough discipline not to ask probing questions, not to prove he's smart, but to just sit there and say, I don't know the answer, and it's okay. Then, you know what he found out? Not only did he know the answer, no one at the next level below him knew the answer. People two and three levels below them figured out how to solve the problem in 10 minutes. Once they got over that egotistical, I'm higher up than you, therefore I have to be smarter than you nonsense, and realized, yeah, I'm higher up in the business ranking than you are. I don't know as much as you about this topic. So why am I pretending to know something why don't I say, really, I'm lost. I don't know the answer. And let's actually find someone who knows what they're doing. And by the way, if they're a union employee, who cares? If they're a first-line supervisor, who cares? Why don't we solve the problem as opposed to proving how smart we are to each other? Well, the company, that was in one moment to change the company. That one event to change the company.
Amazing. Very good. Oh, so hard. The ego is, I mean, I have ego, we all have ego. And it's very, very stressful when we don't take that moment to say, okay, how am I getting in my own way here? And very stressful, and it can sabotage all sorts of aspects that we, you know, going back to early on in the conversation, we all want to be the best person that we want to be, whether it's at work or doing what we're doing, and the ego is the problem.
Let me ask you a question. Have you ever attempted to help friends and family members with your wonderful coaching when they had really no desire for your help?
That's a good question. And back in the old days, I think it would have been before I kind of identified that actually you need to ask their permission to actually have a conversation with them about that. They have to be open to it. They have to be eager to have a conversation. That's the only way that it can work, and for you to just be able to sit down. Otherwise, you know, their brains are going off at 100 miles an hour in the other direction, and they may not be ready for it. So yes, I have. Many years ago, before I had training, it was a disaster. And then when I did receive training, it's like, okay, I've got to breathe, I've got to think about this, and I've got to approach it in a completely different way. Mm. And going back to the ego, which I still, you know, struggle with, you know, if they don't want to sit down and talk about these things, then I have to just let it go. And if try not to, you know, take it either personally or whatever. And so it's a great question, and it's something, quite frankly, I need to mull on a lot more.
Good.
Thank you. So, Marshall, it has been an absolute pleasure having you on this podcast. I think I've had a smile from ear to ear listening to you and your guidance and your knowledge sharing and your generosity of time. It's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you very much.
Oh, I love talking with you. Thank you so much for inviting me.
To learn more about Dr. Marshall Goldsmith, you can find him at marshallgoldsmith.com, where he shares his rich catalogue of materials where you can learn and grow. Head on over to theeirecruiter.com, where you can download 70 tips from best-selling authors, entrepreneurs, AI explorers, emotional intelligence experts, leaders in recruitment, and more. So you are able to kick off your emotional intelligence journey. Until next time, thank you very much for listening.